Call the meeting to order.
Do we have a quorum?
We do have a quorum. So, members, I think what we're wanting to do, and Mr. Cruz, we're going to end a little bit early today because we do have session, all right? I think everybody will appreciate that, so we'll just watch the time closely. With that said, we are looking for additional folks. Mr. Bratz and I, we've been working on this special recognition piece, and we do have some people in the pipeline. We're waiting for the revisor's office to get back to us, right, Mr. Bratz?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman.
All right, wonderful. And so if you have some thoughts about individuals in your areas as well, as far as the special ag recognition, please bring those names forward, and Alex, Mr. Bratz can, yeah, absolutely help us out here. I think we have some new pages today. If you would like to just introduce yourself quick before we get started, that'd be great.
My name is Patrick Levine.
Welcome.
My name is Dan Dodge.
Dan?
I'm Barb Smith.
Barb, welcome. Welcome. So we're happy to have you here. With that said, let's get rolling right away. Mr. Cruz, please state your name for the record, and we can begin.
Santo Cruz, Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Director of Government Affairs. Chair Hamilton, thank you very much for having us back today. As you recall, last week we had an overview of the department with Steve Ernest, our CFO, and our commissioner. Today's a chance for the committee to get to know a little bit more about our individual divisions and their programs. One thing I wanted to mention was there was a late subtraction from today's agenda. Geir Frizeau, who's the division director of the Plant Protection Division, will not be able to make the day for a medical need. We will continue to keep him. I've talked with Mark Knisley, your committee administrator, on Thursday after AURI, if he is able to get back for that. I do apologize for that. That was an unforeseen event. I know that Representative Lueck had questions specifically on the Wolf account. Geir was prepared and did have slides speaking to that today. I will contact Geir and see what the timeline looks like. If it looks like Thursday isn't going to happen, what I will do is I will send the committee the answers to Representative Lueck's questions on the Wolf account in an email so that we're not continuing to have to keep track of that information. But if, in fact, he does appear to be alive and well and ready to go Thursday, we will.
I hope so.
Yes, I've communicated with him by email this morning. We will have him present that on Thursday, then after AURI, with the chair's permission.
Also, well, Mr. Cruz, we always appreciate when Mr. Frizeau comes in because he has show and tell. He always brings bugs, so make sure you bring some bugs along with.
I'll remind him, Chair. Real quick, as the committee knows, we are within a week of the governor's proposal coming out on the budget. So obviously today we are still under the cone of silence, as it were, on what our proposals have been to the governor's office. So those questions won't be able to be answered today. But I do appreciate Chair Hamilton's inviting us here before that process, because it really allows us to focus on the story we have with the investments you've made and looking at the good work that's being done around the agency. Our first presenter today is the Division Director of Ag Marketing, and that is Mary Hanks, and I'll turn it over to her.
All right.
Good morning.
Welcome. Ms. Hanks, please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Mary Hanks, Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Welcome.
Chair Hamilton. The Ag Marketing and Development Division is very diverse. It resulted in a merger 4 years ago between the Ag Development Division and the Ag Marketing Division. The work of each division complemented the other, and 4 years ago I became the director. Prior to that, I was a supervisor and the assistant director for 20 years, so I've been at the department for 24 years. Prior to that, I worked in the seed industry in plant breeding and plant pathology research for 10 years. So I see so many new faces that it might be good to just do a little background on each of us directors to let you know who we are.
Exactly. Thank you.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair. We have a limited time today, so I'm going to just kind of skim over what the division does. If there are any programs that I mentioned today, or if you look at our budget activity narrative that I think you have, and something is of interest to you, we would be happy, my staff and I love to talk about what we do, and we would be happy to come back or meet with any of you individually to talk about any of the programs under our purview. I have a management staff of three supervisors with a combined 55 years of experience at the agency. All came out of private industry before entering public service. The division staff, 40 additional people, and that includes several students and interns. We hire lots of student help, gives them a great experience in the agency, looking at what we do, and also they're great workers, and we like to see them come in. My staff, I'm not going to go into backgrounds because they have as diverse backgrounds as our programs are diverse. And it would take me my whole 7 to 10 minutes to go through that. My division budget is about $18.8 million. Oops, forgot, sorry, forgot to hit play. My division budget is about $18.8 million. $2.5 million of that is a pass-through to the Second Harvest Heartland appropriations that were made last year and the previous year. The remainder, the 16.3, is a mix of general funds, dedicated funds, and federal funds. The majority of the general fund is the $10.235 million in the Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation Program, which I will just briefly talk about as we go along.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
We don't have these slides, do we?
Pardon me? Mr. Bratt said you received this at 9 o'clock last night, so we can get a copy of this,
okay.
Though.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Clark.
I apologize for not having the these in your packet.
Thank you. Mr. Knisley said he'll email that out to everybody. Thank you, Representative Clark.
Thank you.
The Ag Marketing and Development Division focuses primarily on three areas: production assistance, access to markets, and business development and education. In production assistance, we focus on livestock, emerging ag water and conservation technology, immigrants and underserved farmers, biofuels, local and organic foods, and crop research. In the area of livestock, we have dairy profitability teams that worked last year with 287 farms, along with extension, farm business management, veterinarians, feed consultants, and bankers to work with those farms to improve their profitability and efficiencies. We also provide assistance to farmers with feedlot permitting. In the area of water and conservation, last year, 1,680 farmers and ag service providers attended conservation drainage workshops and demonstrations around the state, as well as cover crop on-farm demonstrations and management practices demonstrations. With new immigrants, we work one-on-one with the new immigrant farmers, primarily Hmong, as well as in groups. We've worked with them on insect and disease management practices, business planning and financial management, as well as calling upon the pesticide and fertilizer division to help with safe pesticide and fertilizer use. In the area of local and organic, we just completed the Minnesota Organic Conference about almost 2 weeks ago now. Minnesota is the only state department, has the only State Department of Agriculture that sponsors the statewide organic conference. We had 600 people in attendance this year, as well as an 81 vendor trade show. It was very successful, and we've been doing it for 12 years. Also, we've been working in partnership with the University of Minnesota to help with organic transition practices. The demand for organic products far exceeds the supply, and we're working with new farmers who are interested in transitioning to organic. We also work with farmers to do grazing plans, again, working with primarily dairy and cattle beef farmers to use their pastures and keep more of the land covered year-round. We also work with a number of apple and strawberry growers who volunteer to submit their disease and insect data so that we can pass that on to all of the orchardists and the strawberry growers in the state. Again, production assistance. And in crop research, we provide grants primarily to the University of Minnesota, as well as some to MinSCU, in the areas of new crops, management practices, disease and insect control, quality improvement, new biomass crops or ways to produce biomass more efficiently, as well as cover crops. We also co-manage the biocontrol insect and plant disease quarantine facility at the University of Minnesota. That's in cooperation with CFANS and the experiment station. You can kind of tell from some of the things I'm talking about that this is a very diverse division. We manage a quarantine facility so far. We manage a quarantine facility and work with immigrant farmers. They're kind of opposite ends of the spectrum. The second area we focus on is access to markets. Our major component here for local direct marketing is the Minnesota Grown Program. That's a program that connects consumers and wholesale buyers directly to the producers of agricultural products. Last year, 1,225 farms and markets were listed in our Minnesota Grown Directory, which I hope many of you have seen in your libraries, co-ops, doctor's offices, just about any place. We put those out. And we have an online directory. We're getting away from the paper. And last year, we had almost 300,000 unique hits to our online directory. We go next to international marketing. So we do local foods. We do international. We promote Minnesota commodities, food, feed, fiber, and fuel to international buyers. We host buyers' missions that come to the groups of buyers from different countries come to the state, and we bring our mostly small and medium-sized ag companies to meet with those buyers. Very little expense for the buyers or for the companies. We also lead trade missions in the past. We've led trade missions to China, Vietnam, Colombia, various countries, and it's not just food, but it's often feed. So it's great for our commodities, corn, soybeans, and alfalfa. We also coordinate Minnesota pavilions at some of the large international and domestic food shows and other trade shows. We like to get the Minnesota name up at these shows and have our small and medium-sized companies under our name. Our state name does bring buyers in because they feel like we can be trusted. We bring so many of those buyers into the country to look at how our crops and our food is grown, and they have a lot of confidence in the Minnesota name. Then in business development, which I believe is part of access to markets, we provide both a resource of information for businesses. We get calls from companies that are asking for, where do I find a Minnesota-grown ingredient of some kind? It could be an herb or mushrooms, or it could be corn grits, almost anything you can think of. And we have a really good a list of companies that produce ingredients. We have farmers who produce ingredients, and we can often put those, say a food company that wants to add Minnesota-grown herbs to something, we can hook them up with a grower. We also work with companies who are looking for processing or packing facilities. Often some of the companies have surplus time. They could take a small packer and do a packer process for a smaller company to help them get started. The bulk of what we do, though, in business development is the Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation Program. That's the $10.235 million per year that are the tails of the ethanol producer payments. Those were directed to this program to grow our ag and energy sector. I'm just going to skim over this because I've been assured by the chair that you will see us again to go over this in more detail.
That is correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The areas that we do focus on in agri are livestock investment, value-added business, farm-to-school, beginning and transitioning farmers, food company promotions, and blender pumps. We also have done next-gen energy and crop research, which I mentioned on an earlier slide. One of the other things that we do in business development, we receive federal funds of about $500,000 to cost-share organic certification for those growers in the state, which really helps cover some of their costs. Certification is expensive. This year, we distributed $408,000 to 529 organic farmers and processors. The third area that we focus on is education. I think most of you are familiar with the Ag in the Classroom program. Our main effort here is with K through 12 schools, and we advance ag literacy in those classrooms. 44% of elementary and middle school classrooms in Minnesota use some form of our Ag in the Classroom materials. I just brought a couple of things to show you, and I can certainly get you copies of those when we come back to talk about budgets. But since the addition several years ago, the legislature appropriated money for us to hire a teacher. And that teacher last year met with and trained 866 pre-service and in-service teachers to talk to them about ag literacy and how to use agricultural subjects in their classrooms to meet the state requirements in English, history, math. She's just done a super job, and we appreciate every day the appropriation several years ago. The Ag in the Classroom also works with colleges and universities to get hold of these teachers that are in training, as well as we partner with the Minnesota Ag in the Classroom Foundation. That's a group of university, business, MinSCU, farm organizations. They fund much of what Minnesota Ag in the Classroom does and helps develop materials. So it's very much a partnership. I think I have some performance measures. I think I've already talked about most of these, and I think my time is probably up.
And we do have a few questions.
Sure.
A couple things. First, I'll go to Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Ms. Hanks, I'm curious on the grazing that you talked about. Do you do any kind of coordination with the local SWCDs on your grazing programs and then also, like, with the Cattlemen's Association?
Ms. Hanks.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, we work with NRCS. They have three or four grazing specialists, and we work with several of the SWCDs who have an interest. They also have some great people who are super with grazing in some of the states with more of the rangeland areas. We have one person who works part-time. Well, she works full-time, but she also works with the DNR and is working at doing conservation grazing plans to bring livestock onto some of the state-owned lands as a management tool.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hanks, on the egg, Mag Junior, the previous slide, you said it's in, I think you said 44% of classrooms.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What's the mechanism that's in place for getting that into our schools, into our classrooms?
Mr. Thanks. Chair and Representative Fabian, all of the Ag in the Classroom materials are offered for free. We promote it through, again, the in-service and pre-service training, but also let all the school districts know that this material is free. And we provide packets to teachers who sign up. I know the Agma classroom, we do three of those a year. They just come to their classroom three times a year. There's a teacher's guide. Every school is eligible to get those, and it's kind of word of mouth.
Representative Fabian, follow up?
Yeah, just one last thing. So how do you, you know, I can see where maybe some people might be interested, but there's not enough public awareness. You know, maybe something more to raise the awareness, some more to get these things out there would be helpful to do that, but that's a whole other issue.
Thanks. Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, if you have,
I do.
We'd love
I'll
to have it in 100% of the classrooms. Yep.
And to that point, Ms. Hanks and Mr. Cruz, maybe this would be something to take back to the governor as well. Just last week, Representative Kahn came up here, and we were talking about how we can get more of this in high schools all across the state, right? All across the state, regardless of geographical locations. And she even inkled about possibly some legacy funds to help with that, which I don't know if Representative Erdahl's in here, but I thought that was great. So before the governor releases his budget, go back there and talk about the importance of agriculture in the classroom, and if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, I assure you I will. And just to add one other little asterisk on this, Sue Knott, the teacher who actually was hired through the appropriation from this committee, she had a very, it's a very great idea. She goes around to graduating teachers, and she meets with them before they ever get their first job and explains everything that Mary's just talked about and more about how to meet the standards once they get their first job by using Ag in the Classroom. And it's a fantastic program. And if you'd like to have Sue Knott come forth when we do have our budget presentation, she's got so much energy for this issue.
Thank you. Tell the governor we want a bigger budget, big, big, big budget. All right?
Thank you.
With that, we have Representative Johnson, Representative Anderson, and Representative Clark. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Hanks. When I see marketing and development division, I like to look forward a number of years, and I'm particularly interested. First of all, let me say I think the role you play in the state is critical to add to the economic viability of agriculture and keep it up. We need that, especially in a volatile market. But I'm looking forward, and I'm thinking that increasingly there's needs for perennials, specifically likely alfalfa, and cover crops in terms of the environmental impact, the positive environmental impact that those hold. And yet I also know that whatever we do in those arenas needs to be market sensitive. It needs to be, which implies that a need to create or investigate the creation or access to new markets and export markets, particularly with alfalfa. And I'm just wondering where you're at on that, what you've been doing, and if you're looking forward to doing something in that arena coming forward.
Thank you. Ms. Hanks.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, many of the crop research grants that we've done for the last 2 years using some of the agri funds have been focused on cover crops and biomass crops. And one of the criteria is, are these crops that are being developed through this research, is there a market either from biomass or in some cases they may be oil seeds? Alfalfa again is like the low-hanging fruit. If we could increase the market for alfalfa, we would have lots more green on the ground year-round. We're working with the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division on a project to look at using alfalfa as a marketable crop in, I hope I can say this, in some of the wellhead protection areas. We also see
You can say that.
I can say that? Well, I'm not sure what's in the budget and what's not, so for that division.
It's in there now.
It's in there now.
I'm sorry, Ms. Hanks, please.
I'm just really...
That was Mary Hanks.
That was Mary Hanks who said that. I'm just really excited about that because if we want farmers to keep their ground covered, they need to have some sort of it can't be at a loss. It needs to be marketable, just as you said. And alfalfa is probably going to be one of the easiest. I think canola is It's not a cover crop, but it is a crop that has oil seed. It would diversify the rotation. I think some of the things that the Forever Green Initiative is doing at the U, looking at some crops that are oil seeds, biomass, again, for energy. Again, another, you know, if we can grow it, if there's a market, and if there's a market, we'll grow it. It's kind of chicken and the egg, and we're trying.
Representative Johns.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hanks, as a follow-up, I'm curious. I recognize the work that's been done, and I think it's very valuable. It feels to me that a lot of it, the focus has appropriately been on research, scientific research, application and actually developing crops that are viable to grow and that sort of thing. But I really think the marketing piece is critical. And I'm curious how much of the effort in the past on Forever Green has been towards research versus marketing, and I don't expect these numbers today, but I would also then be expect in the budget that comes forth that same breakdown, and I would hope that there be an increased initiative towards the marketing aspect. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hanks or Mr. Cruz, like a comment?
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Johnson. This is a conversation ripe for our budget proposals and discussions, and I will note for us to cover this when it comes forth.
We want a bigger budget. Bigger budget. I'm, telling that's my leadership as well. So, Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hart, I read over the weekend that the state of North Dakota is looking into beginning a program to attract more dairy farms to their state. South Dakota already does that along that I-29 corridor. What is Minnesota doing in terms of attracting not only dairy farms but other ag businesses to our state?
Ms. Hanks.
Chair Hamilton and Chair Anderson, honestly, I'm going to be very honest. We're not doing a lot to attract new. We do send staff to the Dairy Expo and try to recruit farmers who are there. I think with some of the water problems in California, we are seeing more interest in moving into Minnesota, where we have the luxury of plenty of water, great forage. I think we could do more. We're trying to keep the dairy farms we have, too, through the dairy profit teams. And I think with the dairy authority that was authorized 2 years ago, again, that's research. But if you have a high-caliber dairy research activity in the state, that does attract, we hope, more farms. I would love to hear some ideas about, how the department could do a better job of attracting more dairy and livestock farms.
Chair Anderson, follow-up?
Yeah, thanks again, Mr. Chair. Just a comment that with our neighboring states doing these types of things, I think it behooves us to look more into that and concentrate a little bit more on this recruitment.
Ms. Hanks. Chair and Chair Anderson, as part of the Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation Fund, we do invest $2 million a year in livestock. That's one thing we can do to recruit if we can get more farms into the state. We do have this ability to cover 10% of a project up to $50,000 to expand, to improve, to bring a new member onto the farm. Again, I would love to hear some of the ideas about what more we could be doing.
Thank you. Follow up? Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had two questions. First of all, thank you for the discussion about, the organic certification and the conference that you held. I heard it was wonderful, and I think it was sounds like it was very well attended, hundreds of people. The issue, one of the questions I have is about the organic certification. There's I think somewhat of a myth out there that it's very expensive to do organic certification because people don't know that there is help from the department to help pay that cost to transition, help farmers transition. And if I understood you correctly, you have $500,000 from the federal government. Is the state not putting any dollars into that now? Is it only a federally funded, it's not rebate exactly, but help with that program?
Ms. Hanks.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark. It is only federal dollars. And the federal dollars are used to cost share up to 75% of the cost of certification.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chairman, so did we spend all of that money last year, and is there a waiting list?
Thanks.
Or was there people who were not served, maybe is the way to describe it?
Chair Hamilton and Representative Clark, we served all those people who applied.
President Clark?
So, Mr. Chairman, there, if I understood correctly, you have about $92,000 left over, and some of that, did that go for administration, or is that still available, or what is the situation with that?
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Chair Hamilton, Representative Clark, those dollars go back to the federal government.
So, Mr.
President
Chairman.
Clark, yes.
I'd like to see how we can make sure that people know that those dollars are available, because, again, I think it's kind of a myth that it's so expensive to do organic certification because people are not aware of the fact that there is this help, and apparently not enough Minnesotans at this point. Mr. Chairman, I had one more question. Since the slide is up there on education, Ag in the Classroom, I'm really glad to see that. I haven't seen the document, but does it have... some cultural outreach parts of it. Is it all in English? Does it have any other people depicted? We have a lot of, you mentioned immigrants, and I know you're sensitive to that in the department. A lot of folks from various communities beside the Hmong community who are very interested in farming. And I'm just wondering, we heard from some of the Future Farmers of America last week, is this available in Spanish and Hmong? And we have a lot of Somali people who I hear from where they really want to know if they can't get into farming. There are things like that. Is that document being considered to have that kind of outreach, or, I don't know, are you paying attention to that?
Thanks. Great question.
Chair Hamilton, Representative Clark. I'd like to go back to the organic certification just briefly. We have about 1,100 certified organic farms and businesses in Minnesota. Every one of them is contacted that we know of to be told about the certification cost share. Only about half of them applied. We have no idea why they wouldn't. It seems silly to me not to apply for a cost share. But anyway, the state also has a small amount of money that we are cost sharing for a transitioning farm to work with a certifier during the 3 years of transition. We are cost sharing that with state dollars.
Ms. Hanks, is that a one-time registration fee to become organic certified?
Mr. Chair, certified operations are certified every year.
Okay, thank you.
On to the Ag in the Classroom. We do have the AgMag Junior in Spanish, but that is the only other language. And that was just done this year.
Thank you.
And we understand that it should be translated into other languages.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman.
President
Clark.
I'll just let it go. Maybe see if that might be in the budget, too, following your lead on that discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Representative Dill? I see him. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hanks, I'd like to go back to Chair Anderson's questions and comments about dairy and expansion of dairy operations in the state of Minnesota. Sometimes our regulatory environment in the state of Minnesota gets in the way of some of that expansion. Can you tell me what kind of conversations you have with the Pollution Control Agency with regards to regulations versus economic development and maybe getting some new farmers started? How can we get through some of that stuff, and what does the Department of Ag do to, I'll say, advocate for dairy in this case?
Ms. Hanks or Mr. Cruz?
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Fabian. Clearly there are divisions of responsibilities. PCA has the authority to issue NPDESs and SDSs, which are essentially feedlot permits for discharge for a controlled animal feeding unit. That is not the Department of Agriculture's purview. When we are consulted by the department, the Pollution Control Agency, we try and explain and advocate for agriculture in every way that we can.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Cruz, I would encourage you said that when you are consulted, I would encourage you to make your feelings known rather than waiting to be asked to be consulted and for your opinion. I think it would behoove your agency to be an advocate for agriculture. Not that you're, you know, out there trying to override rules and regulations, but to try to be a voice of common sense, I might say.
Would you like care to respond, Mr. Cruz?
Mr. Chair and Representative.
Say absolutely.
Thank you very much for your perspective, and I absolutely agree. We are here to advocate for agriculture at all times and in all aspects. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. I'm sorry, it was Representative Bly. I had Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Dill's name piece was in front of mine.
So that's what
I understand the confusion of your new.
You're better looking, Representative Bly.
Couple of questions. Thank you, Chair. You know, without belaboring the point, you know, the some of the conversation about new dairy and regulations also has to do with some laws we have in place and some concerns we have about making sure that feedlot regulations are in place for neighbors as well as other farmers. And so, I mean, I think we do need to proceed with caution about that conversation. But the question I wanted to ask about was looking at the AgMag magazine here, and it occurred to me, and this may be a question you don't know the answer to, but I'm wondering if this magazine might also deal with issues that would be like climate change, for instance, and some of the weather changes we see and how farmers are adjusting to that and how that sort of change impacts agriculture. And also the issues about the importance of soil and water to farming and the need to make sure that we're protecting those important resources.
Ms. Hanks?
Representative Bly. The AgMag Junior and AgMag Regular are like kindergarten through fourth or fifth grade. And those things are brought up, the importance of soil, water, the climate in Minnesota. We get into the more complex issues as we prepare materials for middle school and high school. And we have lots of other materials, curriculum around geography and agriculture. And I'd be happy to bring some of those or send some of those to you to give you an idea of what we do cover.
Thank you.
Representative Bly. Done? Okay. We have Representative Backer, then Representative Grunhagen, Representative Metza, and Representative Mariani. So, Representative Backer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A friendly suggestion. I'm the only House district that borders North Dakota and South Dakota. And what may be beneficial, I'm hearing from constituents, it is easier for them to start and expand farm-based, both dairy and crop in North Dakota and South Dakota. May be a good suggestion to see what North Dakota and South Dakota is doing different based on regulations, because that's really what I'm hearing. I know a farmer in Clay County in Representative Marquardt's district that started up in North Dakota just because of the regulation. So, and if that comparison is done, we as committee could set policies to make it easier. And sometimes those type of investments are better than, investing dollars to attract. It'll get out. If we're easier to do business, we're going to get more farmers. So that's my comment. Would be my suggestion.
Thank you, Representative Backer. Care to respond?
Yeah, Chair Hamilton and Representative. Dairy and livestock are very important for the state. They're value added. They add value to our crops, and dairy in particular puts a lot of alfalfa and other crops on the ground that are there year-round. We're huge supporters of the livestock industry, so I take your suggestion very seriously. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hanks. Follow-up, Representative Backer?
No.
All right, thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony, and some of what I was going to comment on has already been said by Representative Fabian and Representative Backer. Just, I've worked with the dairy industry, raised as on a dairy farm for over 35 years. And what I've seen is, especially on some of the smaller herds, 65, 70 dairy cows or so, you know, somebody shows up one day, an inspector, and says, you can't handle manure anymore like you have been handling it. You've got to dig a pit and put your manure in there. And the cost is somewhere between, I think, $150,000, $200,000. Well, both of those dairy farmers, again, they were smaller herds. They decided to throw the towel in because with all their other overhead costs, taxes, regulations, everything else, you just frustrate them to the point where they don't want to do it anymore. And they don't want to take on that debt at their age. I can't remember the average age of the dairy of a dairy farmer, but I think it's over 55. And so we're just pushing them out of business. The other thing, the more taxation and regulations you have, results in bigger and bigger herds of animals in one spot. Okay, in order to increase volume, to because the margins are so low. The result is when you put that many animals in one spot, then you have a lot more problems with groundwater and all the other things. So, you know, I see government, both at the federal and state level, and I know you do a lot of good things, okay? And I'm not blaming you specifically as much as the EPA and the, you know, PUC and the MPCA, and I'll leave the rest of them out. But, you know, they seem to have an antagonistic attitude towards small producers, and then they come down with mandates that drive their costs even higher. And the result is you're social engineering them right out of business because they just don't want to deal with the hassle anymore. So to the degree that you can look at other states and have a reasonable set and cost effectiveness of a regulation before it gets mandated, or if it's already mandated, maybe we need to modify it, as Representative Backer indicated, I would strongly encourage you to be a voice of reason in that area, because we're going to have, the way things are going, you're going to have larger and larger herds of animals in one spot causing more and more problems, and you're going to, you know, social engineer, for lack of a better term, the smaller producers right out of business. And if we want to stop this and actually attract young people, I don't know about you, but I like to eat. So, you know, I mean, that was a habit I developed at an early age. I can't remember exactly, but I know I was hungry. We've got to stop this somehow. And common sense and comparison and evaluation have to be part of the process. To the degree we can help in the legislature, I'd be willing to help. I'm sure everybody else would. So I don't know if you want to make any comments to that.
I would. Mr. Cruz.
Chair and members, I don't want, I think this is a good exchange of ideas and views. However, I don't want to put down the large producers.
No.
Because we represent all of agriculture, both small family farm, and I grew up in Stearns County with less than 100 cows with my nine brothers and sisters, so I'm familiar with what you're talking about. But some of our best environmentalists and environmentally conscious farmers are from extremely large production areas. So certainly there are bad actors out there, but I don't think you can point to one sector of agriculture and say that's where they all live. So I just wanted to offer that.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. It's a new day. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, thanks for that feedback. I didn't mean to disparage large producers in any way. My concern is that the smaller producer is being frustrated and his costs are being increased exponentially, many times by government. And I don't think we should prevent people from getting larger, but I don't think government should be in the business of promoting larger and larger operations at the expense of frustrating the smaller ones. I agree with your comments, all agricultural, but I did not mean to anyhow impugn a large producer. Hey, people get larger, that's fine, but it seems like government is social engineering us in that particular direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Care to comment, either one? Otherwise, go to the Mr. Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I would just add that, you know, we have to stay in our lane at the Department of Agriculture, and when it comes to helping those small farmers, we do have the Agri program. The livestock investment grants, as Mary had said, cannot be used to purchase land or cattle, but they can be used to update a system to grow, to bring home a son or daughter or expand farming. So those are the ways we're trying to satisfy those needs.
Thank you. We do have a number of questions here yet. We'll spend maybe 7 to 10 minutes, if that's okay. All right? We're keeping you a little bit longer. Representative Metza, then Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't get into social engineering, but I did have a question real quick, just to see if you could maybe send the committee a list. I'm sure we'd all be interested in getting the list of school districts working with the department right now, the Ag Mag, and I'd love to work with you on getting a letter out to my districts that maybe aren't, to see if we can, you know, bring that awareness level up like Representative Fabian was talking about.
Thank you, Representative Metza. That's a great idea. Ms. Hanks?
We'll do it.
All right, fantastic. Representative Marianne?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, thank you, Ms. I'll leave that alone. thank you, Ms. Hanks and Mr. Cruz, for your presentation today. I'm a newbie on this committee and in this sector. I've been a legislator for quite a while. And actually, Mr. Chair, asked for this committee when I first came out of the legislature many, many years ago. And I was stereotyped out of it. So it is a new day. I'm really pleased and glad to be here. And to Chair Anderson, I want to thank you for the invitation last week for the FFA students to come. I received a surprising phone call a few days before. I was sick, as it turned out that day, so I couldn't attend. But I had received a surprising phone call from my local high school, which is obviously inner city and heavily Latino, African American, and Asian immigrants. And the invitation was to come and speak to my FFA chapter, which I think Chair Hamilton might have had something to do with over the past few years. And I was stunned. I had no idea. I've always held FFA in great esteem, but had no idea of their presence in the big urban core. And so I'm real pleased to see what's happening in our society. It really is a new day. Ms. Hanks, very broad general question. I am delighted and super impressed by even just a little bit that was shared here. So two things I'm wondering. The first one may not be answerable, and that has to do with whether or not the state of Minnesota has been able to quantify the benefits, if you will, of such a strong state government presence and partnership with our producers and growers across the state. Again, I'm a newbie, and so this notion of this strong governmental sector walking hand in hand with the private sector, if you will, is intriguing to me. And it seems to me a powerful, positive thing for me. So I'm wondering whether or not over the years we've been able to quantify, you know, the what that has meant for us in our state. And then my second question is, as we look at other states, as we look across the nation, how does Minnesota compare to other state government efforts at being able to promote our agricultural sector and to derive a growing benefit to that sector and to the state? Are we not as aggressive as other states, not as assertive? Are we on par with other states? What does the field look like? How competitive is it in terms of this, important role of state government walking hand in hand with our private producers and growers? What's the benefit of all that, and where would you place us among the 50 states in that work?
Oh, thank you. Ms. Hanks.
Mr. Chair and Representative, in particular with the advent of the Agri money, the $10.235 million that we were given, we go back to each recipient of any of those funds and ask them 6 months, a year after they've received the dollars, and ask them what impact it has had. Jobs, impact on profitability, and so we do have that data. The Agri, we've just completed two and a half years of that, so I don't know that we really seen the full impact of those investments. We also, this last year, commissioned a third-party review, impact review, of the first year of the agri funding from fiscal year 13. So when we do talk about agri, I will have a lot of that information, particularly there. Some of the other programs, it's a little bit more difficult. It's like Ag in the Classroom. We'd love to know whether ag literacy improved or not, but kids are subjected to so many tests already and teachers are overwhelmed. We'd love to go in and do a pre-exposure test, you know, what do you know, and then come back. But it would just be overwhelming for the system and for us, for our costs. Minnesota Grown, I'd like to bring my program manager to talk about Minnesota Grown and the impact that has had over the years. So I hope to come back with more of the information you're asking for. As far as where Minnesota stands, I'd love to say that we're number one, that, you know, we're doing the best job in the country in some areas, like I think Minnesota Grown. It's a very old program. I think we were one of the first states to have such a program. The rest, I'd have to do a little research and look at what the state investments are in some of the areas where we're focusing, and I could certainly come back with that information. So, great question.
Thank you. Representative Mariani, follow-up?
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Mariani, you had some students here, and they were phenomenal. Okay. And it was, we put them on the spot. They didn't realize that they were going to be testifying, and they just picked it up and went with it. They were great. They're fantastic. So that was from Humboldt High School.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And your daughter works there, I believe, does she not?
Until recently, yes.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
So all right. She probably knows the number of those students.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing them in.
Oh, they are fantastic, without a doubt. Any other questions, members? Any other questions? So, well, thank you so much for your time, and you'll be back, right, when we're talking about Agria and whatnot?
Yeah, I'll be back.
All right, wonderful. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And for all that you do as well. We appreciate it. Next, Mr. Cruz. Do we have Mr. Bezicki? Or who's coming up next?
Mr. Chair, yes, we have Greg Bezicki and Dan Stoddard of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Group, and I believe we have one of our techs from House here who's going to pull up the technology for us.
Okay. And we saved all of our hard questions for Mr. Bezicki. So yeah, he has it coming. So please, if you would, I'm just teasing, if you would state your name for the record and who you represent and begin, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Greg Bezicki. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And with me is Assistant Director Dan Stoddard. If you don't mind, Mr. Chair, I'll start off. I'll be talking about some of our regulatory programs, and then Mr. Sauter will be talking about some of our non-point and our quality programs.
Thank you.
We've got about 10 slides or so that we'll go through. And Mr. Chair, it's a real pleasure to be here. While we're getting set up, I'll just do a little bit what Mary did, is introduce myself. It's a lot of new members. I've been with the department since 1985, so this will make 30 years. I've been in this position since 1994. Prior to that, I was actually working at the University of Minnesota, and I've got a master's in soils. I was a soil fertility researcher. And I ran a field crew over there, and so I had the great privilege of working in, I'm not going to say every district, every of your districts, but most of them, I would guess, over the time that I was there. And it's been a real pleasure to work for the department and work for agriculture and work on ag issues and environmental issues and represent agriculture. So what we'll do today is just, we've got a very short presentation. Of course, we'll answer questions, but what we're really trying to do is introduce the committees to what we do and who we are. We'll certainly try to answer questions, but we have a very large division, a lot of responsibilities, so if we can't answer the question today, we'll get back to you. We're the state lead agency for the regulation of pesticides and fertilizers, and as such, we deal with an awful lot of environmental issues. One thing that's always important to clarify is pesticides is a broad term. It means herbicides, insecticides, fungicides, rodenticides. We regulate all of that. We regulate it in urban areas and rural areas. So most everything that deals with pesticides or fertilizers comes through our division. There's a few exceptions, but most everything is there. The Groundwater Protection Act in 1989 rewrote pesticide and fertilizer law. It gave the department a tremendous amount of authority and new responsibilities. For example, we became the emergency responder for agricultural chemicals in the state, both emergency and long-term. And we have a program funded by a surcharge on all products and licenses that provides basically an insurance fund for spills. At the time, there was a tremendous amount of contamination from ag chem facilities. This fund has helped to clean that up. It provides reimbursement of 80% of $350,000. So our authority is vested in Minnesota Statutes 18B, C, D, and E, and in 103H, the Groundwater Protection Act. Mr. Chair, legislators, you're missing the most exciting slide. We also are the state lead agency for FIFRA, which is the federal law that regulates pesticides. So you saw a number of the programs up there. In addition to some of the things I mentioned, these are just a few of the things we do. We do waste pesticide collection programs. Mr. Chair, there's a question about where we rate in the country. I say we're the number one state in waste pesticide collection in the country, with the exception of Texas. But they don't play fair. They have something called sheep dip down there. So they put pesticides in a big tank and they run their sheep through it. And then they dispose of all that water with pesticides in it, and then they have more tons than we collect. Mm-hmm. We collect an awful lot. And at the time, for example, I'm just going to do a little aside here, but one of the things that growers, farmers in Minnesota did very well is they didn't dump their pesticides. So back then, we were collecting a lot of agricultural chemicals. Most of that was from agriculture. Now it's completely flipped around, where we believe that most of the products are actually coming from, and our surveys show that most of them are coming from urban areas, the premixed stuff. Whereas agriculture used the technology and they reduced the amount of waste pesticide that was in the stream. Now they use commercial applicators and they use ultra low volumes and so forth. So back then, agriculture delivered on their promise, which is to reduce waste pesticide, and we see that. We still have a lot of waste pesticide to pick up, and one of the things that farmers are still to be congratulated for is it's amazing how much stuff that we bring in that was banned back in the 70s, DDT, 2,4-5-T, and Dilbit. Just as an example. One of the other things that we do, and this is not a regulatory program, it's a non-regulatory program, but in housed in my division, is also the Minnesota Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program, and I know, Mr. Chair, that you're going to be talking about that more later, but that's in my division. Okay, so how do we do this? We work with farmers, regulated industry, and interested parties on the front end as much as possible. What does that mean? That means I heard the questions about regulation, and as a regulator, okay, that made me a little nervous. I didn't leave the room. I came down here. That's my job. But what I learned when I came here from the University of Minnesota, and I wasn't a regulator, is that regulation provides a level playing field. Make sure that we get the right information to all the growers, and if people are breaking the law, they're held accountable. But what we try to do is conduct workshops to make sure people know what they're supposed to do. And when we're coming up with new regulations and so forth, we try to get people at the table in advance to talk about how those regulations might affect people, how it's best to work with them. And frankly, it's one of the things that we take a great deal of pride in, is trying to get people at the table, hear all the different points of view before we proceed. So we understand the concern about overregulation and so forth, yet we also recognize that there needs to be these rules in place for all, everyone's protection. Okay, so one of the things we do is we hire agronomists and soil scientists, and hydrologists. We have a lot of technical people on our staff. A number of our staff have PhDs. A number of have masters. Some of those people who have masters are actually working in the field as inspectors. So it's a very sophisticated, intelligent group of people. But at the same time, a number of them have farming backgrounds. A number of them still farm. About 40% of our staff is in greater Minnesota, and we have about 117 staff. The budget, which we'll be talking about more later, is about $25 million a year. A lot of that money actually goes as pass-through in various sources, whether it's research or reimbursement or for a service program like waste pesticide collection. Most of our funds come from fees, and more recently we've been very active in obtaining and using clean water funds, which again Mr. Stoddard will talk about.
Your time's up.
All right. And with that, there's no more time for questions. Just a couple more slides, and then I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Stoddard. These are some of the activities that we're involved with. We're involved with many more, but for example, I think I mentioned we register 13,000 pesticide products. Those products pay fees. They pay a surcharge for the collection of waste pesticide, and they also pay into the ACRA fund. We have 21 categories for licensing. We have about 11,000 more commercial applicators, and we have about 17,000 private pesticide applicators. We do not regulate manure. I think that was said earlier. There's two exceptions, though. One is we do have the responsibility to license commercial animal waste technicians. These are commercial applicators. In fact, they came to us a couple of years ago, and they asked for a stronger pesticide commercial applicator regulatory program. We've increased that activity there, and we're doing some innovative things, such as testing over the internet. The other thing we do is we regulate manipulated manure. For all the dairy farmers and animal agriculture, that's nothing more than composted fertilizer by the nursery. That's all. Those are two areas. Last slide is basically here's some of the activity that we deal with, incident response. We do 24/7 response, so emergencies. We have emergency site cleanups. We have long-term cleanups. We have voluntary cleanups. If somebody's doing a property transfer, we'll help with a voluntary assessment and cleanup. We have the ACRA account, as I mentioned, and then we, to make ACRA work, we also have the ability to do Superfund. That was something that we got in the Groundwater Protection Act. So that is kind of the gorilla in the closet. We do Superfund cleanups, but only when people are reluctant to clean it up, or if we have orphan sites, things of that nature. So we work in partnership with the Pollution Control Agency. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Stoddard, and then we'll be happy to answer questions after he's done with his presentation.
Okay. Mr. Stoddard.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm also Assistant Director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. Thank you for the opportunity of being here today. And,
welcome.
To go over our programs at the early in the session. Just a little bit of background about myself. I have been with the Department of Ag since 1990, so about 25 years. I've been Assistant Director for Environmental Programs for about 17 years, since 1997. I'm a hydrogeologist by training. Most of my career has been spent working with water programs and groundwater. I also have a master's degree in something called Management and Technology from the Carleton School of Media Institute of Technology. And that is a professional degree to manage science and technology-based programs, especially multidisciplinary programs. And we are very definitely a science-based program. Very nice. My primary role at the department is I work mostly with the water programs. I coordinate water staff and work with other agencies on water issues. As Greg mentioned, we have very technical staff. in the non-point source area, we have about 50 people in different program areas. Almost all of them are scientists. Many of them have advanced degrees, and 50% have PhDs. So we are, as I mentioned, very science-based programs. Just a little background, non-point source, what that means from a practical standpoint is that is some kind of an impact or effect from the normal legal use of a product. So our division does all aspects of pesticide management, fertilizer management. This is from legal use of products. We actually have four general areas that we work in. One is non-point source impacts from groundwater, or to groundwater from nitrogen fertilizer. Non-point source impacts to surface water and groundwater for pesticides. Other health and environmental risks from pesticides, and then water quality monitoring from pesticides and fertilizer. I'd comment that the Pollution Control Agency is the lead agency for surface water impairments, so we serve in a reporting, supporting role for them, but they really take the lead for nitrate and surface water. So a little bit on our general approach, how we do our work and our culture. Our approach is to understand the science first before we make decisions and use the science for decision making. Many of the issues that we work with are very, very complex. In particular, I'll talk about nitrate and groundwater. It's a very difficult issue. Regardless of how good a farmer is, nitrate is leaky. Only a certain percent of the nitrate applied is actually used by the crop. And if the weather conditions are adverse and the crop doesn't grow, or you have a lot of rain right after you apply, you can get significant leaching into groundwater, even if the grower does everything perfect. So it's a very, very challenging issue. One thing that we really value is the ag community. So our goal is to protect water resources. We take that mission very seriously. And we're looking for ways to do that and maintain a strong agricultural economy. We recognize the importance of ag in the state. We are ag. We need to find a way to accomplish both. Those are the kinds of things that we're focused on. We try to involve the agricultural community and other stakeholders in problem solving. Our experience is that the ag community, especially working at the local level, they are the ones who come up with the best solutions. They are the ones who really understand what's going on in their area. And they are very willing to participate, providing that we develop conditions that are reasonable, where they know that they're being respected, where they know that the science is on the table and we're talking factually about things. We also try to build relationships with other programs and plans. Water issues are big, and there are many different players. And so it's our goal to try to be a bridge and work with these players. In particular, right now, there's multiple agencies who are participating in water. We represent agriculture when working with the other agencies. They still have their authority, but we have a number of advisory teams, which I think are working very, very well. We sit down and we talk about common ground, and usually there is common ground. So I think part of our role is to make sure that we're bringing the ag perspective and good science to a lot of these discussions with other agencies. I was specifically asked to say a few words on how we coordinate with DNR groundwater management areas. So the Department of Natural Resources is the lead for this concept called groundwater management areas, where they're developing teams. DNR's role is to manage water quantity. Our role is the ag input. And so they have consulted with us from the very beginning, and we do participate in these groundwater management areas. We have a regional staff person who's assigned to each one. We review the data that they're presenting, make sure that it's accurate. We also present the ag perspective. Working with local growers, we also make sure that the University of Minnesota and other experts are involved where appropriate. So we are active in the groundwater management concept. So I'm going to go through our three major areas. Lost it again. First one is nitrogen fertilizer non-points. We have about 25 staff who are involved in this area. One of the things that we manage is called the Nitrogen Fertilizer Management Plan. That is the state's blueprint for how we're going to address nitrates in groundwater. We recently revised the plan. We're just about finished with the revision. We should be releasing it very, very soon. And we're already beginning implementation of many aspects of the plan. We also work with fertilizer best management practices. We have a statutory responsibility for developing those practices and promoting them. We actually don't develop the practices. The University of Minnesota develops the practices, but we work very closely with them. We identify needs, and we fulfill some of the administration requirements to make sure that they're made public. We closely support their efforts. We provide technical assistance to the impaired waters process. So we participate in some of the state level and local decision making. We make sure that information used is accurate. We have a number of different kinds of projects to promote and evaluate DMPs at the local scale. We have projects like the Root River Project. We support Discovery Farms in Minnesota, Precision Conservation. We're involved in a number of different activities to make sure that the technical information used for impaired waters is accurate. We fund research. We get a certain amount of money from the Clean Water Fund. It's $2.1 million. And we have an interagency team, and we work with other stakeholders to identify priority research needs. We don't conduct the research. We just make sure that the research is done appropriately and it's addressing needs for priority needs for research. So we work with the other agencies. We've done a number of very significant proposals. We were the first entity to get LIDAR, so precision conservation on the ground. We recently released something called an AgDM handbook, which is a handbook which identifies practices and potential impacts from those practices. Right now, we're funding about $1 million of cover crop and agricultural research at the University of Minnesota. We just released the request for proposals, which includes, in part, a more formal process for evaluating how to fund cover crops and vegetative cover. Because I think there's a lot of interest, and our agency strongly supports that approach, but we want to make sure that it's being done in a logical and sequential manner. We also certify soil and manure testing laboratories. So we are the only agency or entity in the nation that certifies manure testing labs. We identified this need quite a few years ago. It's not exactly exciting. We have a person who collects manure samples and homogenizes them and sends them off to labs all across the nation and in Canada to make sure that the sampling results are comparable. You're very welcome to come up for a tour if you want. It's a popular thing. This is one of the things that is perhaps not too exciting, but really important for agriculture.
So, Mr. Stoddart, you might get a appreciate this. Here, a while back, there was a paper that was released from the University of Minnesota from Mr. Giles Randall, and it was titled Gunk versus Gold, and it was manure versus commercial fertilizer. And my employer handed me that and said, we will not build another site unless we get reimbursed for the nutrients within the manure. And I said, because I was in business development, I said, you want me to be a manure salesman? And he said, absolutely. There's a value there. The University of Minnesota has proven it, and we will not build another site unless we get reimbursed for application costs or the value of the nutrients within. And the agronomy department was born. It was phenomenal.
Sure.
So thank you.
Like a good business decision.
Absolutely. Thank you.
One of the things that we do, we also have a section for pesticide non-point source activities. It's about 13 people, again, all ag scientists. In this case, we have a number of entomologists. As Greg mentioned, we are the lead state agency in the state of Minnesota for addressing pesticide issues. We're the EPA delegated lead. Pesticides are significantly different than fertilizer in our approach. Pesticides are much closer regulated. What many people don't realize is that the label is the law. We can and do if we have to take enforcement action on abuse of the pesticide label. It's important to remember that when somebody's using pesticides, especially agricultural pesticides, there is an expectation that there will be some losses. When they're used in the environment, we expect some loss. We do see it. Our statutory mandate is to prevent unreasonable adverse effects on the environment. So some loss is expected. Also, much of our work is in both urban and rural areas. So I think a lot of people think of us as rural. But pesticides are a very significant concern, especially for health in urban areas. For example, with bed bugs. We spent a lot of time working on bed bugs. We funded Dr. Steve McKells at the University of Minnesota. I wrote a lot of literature because people are afraid of bed bugs. When they have bed bug problems, they're really vulnerable to using highly toxic pesticides in very inappropriate ways. So we have both a significant urban and rural presence. We have something called a pesticide management plan, and this is our blueprint for how we manage pesticide impacts to water resources in the state. Pesticides are frequently detected in groundwater, especially in vulnerable areas, but the concentrations are nearly always below drinking water standards. They also are very commonly detected in surface waters. There's a couple of impairments now for currently used pesticides, but considering the use and the amount of monitoring that we do, we do find very many exceedances of the standard in surface waters. What we do is we have a program in place where we monitor the waters of the state, and then we have an annual meeting with a number of different stakeholder groups, including the other agencies, where we review the data. They provide advice to us on what actions are appropriate, and then we follow through with taking those actions. So it's a closed loop, and then we'll evaluate those actions and continue monitoring and have another meeting next year. So it's an ongoing process. We also are responsible for developing pesticide best management practices, but our approach is a little bit different than fertilizer. For pesticide BMPs, our agency actually writes the BMPs, but we do it in very close consultation with the University of Minnesota, and also in this case, we bring in ag groups and stakeholders who have expertise in the product. We register pesticide products. So we have something called special registration reviews, which are mini reviews focused on Minnesota-specific issues. We do not duplicate EPA's work. We don't have the resources. But we do come in, and when there are Minnesota-specific concerns, we'll evaluate them and prepare a report, and we can take action if necessary. A new responsibility that we've had is pollinators. This is something that really attracted the public's attention. We have a significant role in it, but it's really, for us, fairly new. But we have some excellent entomologists on staff who are really capable of working on issues. One project that we recently completed is developing habitat BMPs for pollinators in urban and rural settings, and that was very successful. And we had a lot of support. I think everybody that we've seen so far enjoyed the process and was pleased with the outcome. And the last thing that I'm going to comment on is water monitoring. We have, I think, 11 staff working in that. We do long-term pesticide monitoring. We have well networks across the state, especially focused in areas that are vulnerable to groundwater, and that's primarily the Central Sands area in southeast Minnesota and then certain river valleys around the state. It's a very sophisticated monitoring network. One of the questions that we constantly get is, how come all the agencies don't combine their monitoring program? You really need to monitor for its intended purpose. Monitoring criteria, the approach, and even the well design are all designed for a specific purpose. We've been monitoring pesticides for over 25 years. We have a data set which is unparalleled, and it's extremely useful for decision making. Many people are concerned about pesticides. When they raise questions about pesticides, we have hard data on what's going on. And I will say that for groundwater, the frequency of detection has stayed fairly constant, but we have very low detection levels, part per trillion. But the concentration for pesticides has been dropping. So it's actually a pretty good story for pesticides. But it is certainly a concern. We support discovery farms. One of our areas of expertise is edge-of-field monitoring. This is much more difficult than it sounds. You actually have to be out there on call all year long. And it's automated equipment, which is really vulnerable to breaking down, and it has to be designed to manage a whole range of environmental conditions. You can have huge rainfall events, which can overwhelm monitoring networks. So we are really good at this, both the tie lines and surface water. Discovery Farms is something that we strongly support. It's a farmer-led initiative to evaluate and demonstrate BMPs. But we are strongly involved in Discovery Farms because we do the monitoring for them. We make sure that all of the information collected is public, the process is transparent, it's technically accurate and dependent. We monitor private wells for nitrates. This is one of the outcomes from our revision of the Nitrate Fertilizer Management Plan. We are proposing to sample all of the vulnerable areas in the state. We use a township sample. So vulnerable is defined as groundwater, which is sensitive to contamination, and row crop agriculture. We're proposing to offer all of those wells for nitrate sample. And then the plan is to identify those areas that are high risk across the state. And we're well into this process. We've been doing this for a couple of years already. And I want to comment that we coordinate our monitoring with other agencies. In particular, the Pollution Control Agency has a monitoring program. They monitor in urban and non-ag areas. We monitor in edge of fields in very, very ag settings. And we work together. So we will collect samples for them. They collect samples for us. It's really a cooperative effort. Same thing with the Department of Natural Resources. They're installing a very extensive network of monitoring wells to evaluate water level data. And we talk to them, and if they're putting in a well in a place where we can use it, we'll use those wells. And then finally, I'd say that we have an annual monitoring report, so all of the data that we collect is put in a report available.
Thank you, Ms. Stoddart. We do have some questions. We have Vice Chair Keel, Representative Clark, Representative Bennett, and Representative Vice Chair Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bozicki, I was just curious. We started this water quality program, certification program, 2 years ago, so I realize it's fairly new, but I'm wondering, how is it going? How many farms have you been able to sign up, and are they to the certification program yet, or are you still working on that, finalizing it so that they have that 10-year program?
Mr. Bozicki. Okay.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Keel, the program, I'm going to turn this over to Santa, but I will say the program is going well. There's about 30 or so farms that have been certified, but there's many, many more in the pipeline. And what I've been impressed with is the enthusiasm that I've seen when I've gone to the advisory meetings from growers and from people who've certified, who are very proud of the fact that they now have something that can attest that they're doing a good job. So it's new, but it's up and coming, and it's off to, I think, a very good start. And I'll turn this over to Mr. Santa and Cruz.
Mr. Cruz.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Keel, this was the program that just received the $9 million from the RCCP program from the federal government in recognition of the competitive process. So I think it has good conceptual outlay. Chair Hamilton has been gracious enough to let us know that there will be an extensive hearing on the details of this program because, as you said, it is new and there are a lot of questions about how it actually hits the land and how the buy-in is going in. As Mr. Bozicki said, we have about 250, 260 farmers in the pipeline to become certified. We do have just between 35 and 40, or 33 and 40 registered farmers. But what's important to know about those particular numbers is, one, we're talking about roughly 10,000 acres already certified. Two, the certification process, the Department of Agriculture is the lead signatory, actually the sole signatory for purpose of the contract. So there we've assumed the authority through the permission and a compliance agreement with the other agencies that have responsibility in water quality to make this determination and sign this contract with the farmer. And I think that's very important to highlight. And then lastly, I would just mention that I think the program has been up and running to accept applicants now for 6-7 months. So it's been a relatively short window that farmers have had the opportunity, and the response has been overwhelming. If you look at other states that have similar programs that are statewide, whereas we just have certain watersheds that have been selected as pilot projects, some of their numbers don't even equal what we have. And we're only focused on a very, very small number of watersheds.
Representative Gill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for that information, and I'll look forward to more conversation about it. I have another question. When you talked about manipulated manure, I'm assuming you regulate those businesses who incorporate manure into the, you know, the process of pumping it out of the pits and incorporating it in the ground as opposed to spreading it. How is that? Do you have a lot of businesses that are regulated by that, or how is that working for you?
Mr. Bozicki.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, trying to recall, I think we've got about 150 companies, individual companies, that are commercial animal waste applicators. There's a few that are large. A lot of them are smaller operations. They came to us several years ago, I want to say 3 or 4 years ago, and wanted more. And when we explained that they were only paying fees for a minimal program, they asked for an improved program because they wanted to be seen as professionals, and they didn't believe that if they weren't licensed and if there wasn't proper enforcement and inspections, that they wouldn't be taken as professionals. So we worked with them to actually design a licensure program. One of the key things that they wanted was they wanted a two-level licensure system with a site manager who would be kind of licensed at a higher level, and then the applicators who are important, but they're not managing, they're driving the vehicles mm-hmm. and so forth. So we worked with them to actually come up with a online test that they can take and receive certification. So because the turnover is quite high, that way that we will be able to actually help with the training and make sure they get the proper training, and that will happen very quickly. That is, we're in the process of that. There's enthusiasm. Frankly, we're pleased to be working with them, and it will. We're not completely there yet, but we're getting there.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, your comment about now selling that manure out of the pits, do you perceive that to be a more oftener, it's not used a whole lot in my district because we don't have as many animals. However, my brother actually does this with the fields that he has around his hog operation. But do you perceive more of that purchasing of manure to be increasing in the state?
Mr. Bezicki.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel, I think it has been increasing over a number of years. Perhaps some of you would know the market better than I. But my understanding is there has been a pretty good demand for this for a number of years now. I would mention one thing, and this is on the downside. When we're looking at the nitrogen fertilizer management plan and proper crediting, as Mr. Stoddard talked about, it's very important to make sure that we're just applying the right amount of nutrients, whether it's coming from manure or crediting alfalfa or fertilizer. And that's one of the areas in our follow-up surveys that we have found is that we could do a lot better job as a state in crediting the nutrients from manure. So that's maybe something that all of us need to be working on. But I think there's a huge demand for it. I think it's a very popular material to use. We don't regulate the actual sale of that. That's between the two businesses. We just regulate the applicators.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one comment. I can see that, you know, we're evolving as we, like you mentioned, that, you know, it used to be that we put fertilizer down once a year, spring or fall, and now we're seeing people use it in different amounts, much more. Even like our chemicals that we use are used in micro rates, much less. Just in my lifetime, I think it's just the chemical application or the pesticide and the fertilizer has really changed from how we used to do it. And we're very precise about what we put down now, not just because of cost, but because of good practices. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Manure versus commercial fertilizer. Manure outperformed commercial fertilizer by 8.1 bushels per acre in that study. There is a value, no question about it. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment first. I heard you say the problem with pesticides in the urban area being really a problem, and I'm very interested in hearing about what we might do, those of us who represent urban areas, to deal with that if they're more of a problem than we have been accounting for. So consider me a person to talk with about that. I have a couple questions, though. I was made aware recently of some fairly current issues of pesticide drift affecting organic farmers and causing their crops to not be able to be organically certified because of the drift. And I think this is because of flyovers, pesticides being applied from the air. So I know we've had this issue over the years about, you know, people's right to know what it is that their crops are being drifted onto. What is the chemical or the pesticide? And also, it's not always farms. It's also a health issue. So, you know, families' homes being under the cloud or receiving the drift. So I'm just wondering, can you tell me where we are with protections for both the organic farmer from this and then the public and family homes and people who have had health issues because of pesticide poisoning, inadvertent probably, from spraying pesticides? What is the department's role these days, and what are the tools you have or don't have to deal with that.
Thank you. Representative Bezicki, or Mr. Bezicki, sorry. You were just demoted.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the brief promotion. Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, pesticide drift onto non-target areas is a violation of the law. Mm-hmm. And we respond to that. We respond to 50 to 70 such complaints each year, and we do investigation. We'll do a screening depending upon what we find and so forth. If we believe there has been a violation of the law, we go and investigate that. We'll gather evidence, submit it to the laboratory. We're very much like the police or CSI, however you want to do that. We take samples and we talk with the applicator. We do very thorough investigation. And frequently, we hold people accountable for violations. Sometimes we find that a violation didn't occur. Sometimes we do, and then that evidence is made public when the case is closed. So that's kind of the overview of what we do. When we're dealing with organic land and organic certification, that creates an additional problem because of the cost it takes, the years that it takes to have the land without pesticides, the value of the crop versus if it has been exposed to pesticides and marketing and all of those. We're very familiar with that. In fact, I'd say about a month ago, I was meeting with the organic board on this very issue, and we talked about this. So, probably the biggest thing that we have advanced is promotion of the of DriftWatch. And DriftWatch is a program. It's a multiple state program. It's run at the state level. We're participatory in it, and we encourage all folks who've got vulnerable crops or vulnerable situations to register on DriftWatch. It's, for example, organics, organic growers, vegetable growers, vineyards, and so forth, so that the applicators can look at that. It's quite sophisticated, and they can look at that, and they know exactly where those growers are. So it's that encouraging of that modern day across the pickup a conversation, know where the growers are and where people have to be especially careful for. Careful. If we do find a violation onto an organic grower, we again develop the case. It's made public, and then it actually frequently goes to court. It's a civil action between the person who allegedly drifted on, or if we finally drifted on, and the landowner. And that's how it's settled. We may have issued a fine, but we don't recoup all the cost of all of that.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, so do you have the tools you need? Are there, well, I guess there's two questions. Do people have a right to know when they've been drifted on? I mean, what the chemical is? And then second, are there penalties? And when was the last time there was actually a penalty administered? Do you know?
Mr. Bezicki.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, there's penalties all the time. We issue, just on misuse alone, I think we probably issue 30 or 40 penalties each year, just on drift. And yes, we do have the tools. I think it was about, I want to say 5 or 6 years ago, that there were some changes that were made so that, first of all, if someone is drifted on and they are personally exposed, we get the information to them. We actually have some tools to make sure that we can get the information to them. We work with, and it's vetted with the Department of Health. That was the change that took about five or 6 years ago. I think the biggest thing we need to do is get more people registered on DriftWatch and get more applicators using that. I know a lot of applicators do use it. We'd like to see more, and I know a lot of organic folks are registered on it. We'd like to see more.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one final question, yes. A different one. Thank you, Ms. Stoddard, for bringing up the issue of bed bugs. I do know what you're talking about. It's certainly in major population areas, it's a big problem, and it has nothing to do with people having dirty homes or anything like that. It's not a cleanliness issue. It's an infestation issue. And I have talked with people who have been so frustrated that they've gone out and bought very toxic chemicals to put in their apartment, and it's disastrous. But what I wanted to ask you is, since the Department of Ag is concerned with pests, would this be an area, the solution, Mr. Chairman, maybe others know, is to provide a heat machine that heats up the room or heats up the apartment or heats up the place where the bed bugs are, kills them. It's non-invasive in terms of health, but it costs money. And I'm just wondering, is this something that we could ask the Department of Ag to help with this pesticide? I mean, I've thought about it for some of my public high-rises where we have a lot of elderly people who are just being driven crazy by this problem, and they're worried that it has nothing to do with how clean they keep their apartments. It has to do with the fact that once you have a bed bug infestation, it came in some mattress or it came in, you know, some chair or something, and they just can't deal with it. Is this something that I can come and talk with you about helping us with the cost of dealing with these? Is this under your jurisdiction is my question.
Thank you. Mr.
Chair,
Bezicki.
Representative Clark, first of all, I want to underscore what you said. This is this is an issue for all economic levels and everyone. It's amazing. I did my little stint out at the State Fair when we had the big bed bug display out there, and it was very interesting to see the reaction of everybody who came through when they realized that they had bed bugs. It was, if they did, it's a very costly thing to deal with. The industry that deals with this, the structural pest control industry, they're the ones who actually have the heaters and the implements. It's a commercial entity, obviously. They are very busy. And we have not talked at all about providing any help and assistance and so forth, but I think that's something that the legislature would be, you know, certainly could consider. We have not. We know the industry is very active, and I'm not sure if they can keep up with demand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Clark. We are going to end in 3 minutes, all right? So, Mr. Cruz, we're going to reschedule. We do have a couple more questions if you want to answer them. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was following up on Representative Keel's question. I was trying to think back to the turn of the last century and who worked on the commercial manure applicator program. How did that start? Who were the bureaucrats that worked on that? And how did it get implemented?
Mr. Bezicki.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I will tell you the origins of the language actually came as a solution in the famous feedlot wars, and that was parceled out, and I believe you may have had something to do with it.
Representative Hansen, did you have something to do with that?
I think so.
Yeah.
My memory is getting a little foggy, but I think it was an example of the industry, the general public, and folks getting together and getting training manuals. So that's 98, I think, was the legislation. I think we provided a grant to the university for manuals in 99 for about 110,000 at the time. And those manuals lasted until about 3 or 4 years ago when we moved to the online thing. So I think it's good to show that the agency keeps evolving with technology and as new information gets in there, because it's been, 15 years back to 2000. It was just yesterday, I think, that happened.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair, and for those of you who aren't aware, I had the privilege of hiring Representative Hansen many years, well, just a couple of years ago. but this is actually a really good example of how a level playing field and how regulation can serve agriculture and everyone, because this was part of the solution in the feedlot discussion was to actually bring in a similar training program which had been, and it was modeled after the private pesticide applicator training program, and I think that's helped everybody. So,
Thank you, Mr. Bezicki. And Representative Hansen, I was the producer that was appointed to the Manure Management Advisory Council back there, so back then. So our paths crossed back then. We're going to do some quick announcements, and then once again, thank you so much. I apologize to the others that were on the list, but this is great discussion, and I'm not going to cut it off. I mean, we're going to bring you back and have some additional conversation around all this. So thank you so much, Mr. Cruz. We'll work with you on getting that rescheduled.
Absolutely, Chair.
Some announcements. Tomorrow's policy meeting is not an official joint hearing. However, I know Chair Anderson invites everybody to attend. It's groundwater management, correct, with the DNR. And so testimony from the Irrigators Association. On Thursday, the 22nd, a joint hearing on ag finance and ag policy. We have AURI, Marl, and continuation of this as well, okay? And then ag finance overview, the spreadsheets that are in your folder, if you could please put those in the save folder so we don't kill any more trees than what we have to, all right? With that, thank you so much for your testimony, and like I said, it's a new day for agriculture. Thank you. Meeting's adjourned.